Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, was the most infamous and terrifying serial killer in Britain of the 20th century. Active as early as 1969, Sutcliffe was ultimately arrested for the murder of 13 women and attempting to murder a further 7 more. The Yorkshire Ripper attacks and the media circus surrounding his activities scarred the nation and led to an enormous, desperate police operation to catch the killer, unlike any other in the history of Great Britain. It remains, to this day, among the most famous, controversial, and significant manhunts ever undertaken in Britain. On today's episode of Cold Case Detective, I have the great privilege to discuss this investigation with retired West Yorkshire police officer and actor Bill Blackwood. Bill very generously gave me a 40-minute window to discuss his own incredible insights into the case, as he lived through the Yorkshire Ripper's reign of terror in Yorkshire at the time, and joined the West Yorkshire Police Force in 1982. This means he knows as much about the investigation as pretty much anyone could, all the while having a distance from it to offer an unbiased, intelligent, and, as I'm sure you'll find, fascinating account of the investigation. We discuss the personalities involved, the failings and successes of the police, the impact of the media whirlwind, and the evolution of investigative police work in the years that have passed. Please sit back and enjoy this interview with Bill Blackwood, telling us the incredible story of the hunt to catch the Yorkshire Ripper. Bill, thanks so much for being here today. It's wonderful to have you on. Just before we kick off, do you want to share a little bit about yourself and when you got started on the force?
Yeah, well, it's lovely to meet you, and it's nice to be here. Thanks for inviting me. I joined West Yorkshire Police in 1982, the year after Peter Sutcliffe was actually convicted. It was information that was still fresh at the time, and obviously very much in the forefront of people's minds. I joined in 82, did all the usual sort of things you have to do in your probation in the police service, and did a lot of other exciting things throughout the time there, and was medically retired in 2002, sadly, having served 20 years in the force.
Incredible.
And then went on to do other things.
I suppose we should just kick right off. I mean, you've obviously had a lot of insight into the Yorkshire Ripper investigation and worked with a number of people who were involved in the inquiry. Can you share any details regarding the investigation?
Yeah, I mean, I joined in 1982, and the divisional station that I went to was next door to Milgarth Street Police Station, where the inquiry was actually based. And a lot of the detectives who had worked on the inquiry were now back working divisionally. All really solid, nice people, all very experienced detectives. Some of them had worked in Special Branch, for example. Some of them had been working as detectives for many long years. So the guy in charge of the entire case, George Oldfield, on the back of the M62 bombers, who he managed to gain a conviction for, which was more recently overturned because of the evidence that was presented. He was assigned to be the senior investigating officer on the Ripper case. The Ripper case was unique, really. It was one of the largest police inquiries into a serial killer that this country's ever seen. And as such, it's a difficult one to imagine back in the 70s how those things were being dealt with. We're used to having computerized systems. We're used to being able to transfer information in nanoseconds from one place to another. Back in the times that the Ripper inquiry started, all intelligence systems ran on file index cards. All things were run on paper sheets. All actions for detectives to go out and make inquiries were handled as a piece of paper, not as an electronic message. I know they had to reinforce the floors at Milgarth Street Police Station underneath the inquiry team's offices because of the sheer weight of the paper that they actually accrued there.
That is incredible.
Imagine if you're looking for, I don't know, a specific name that's cropped up in the inquiry, you have to go to And if you remember them, library file index cards in the little wooden drawers is exactly what the local intelligence officers and the intelligence officers working on the inquiry ran on. They had little wooden drawers with little cardboard index cards in them that had people's information written on them that might refer you to another file else somewhere else. So it was an interesting way to conduct an inquiry, but that's the way it was done. As I say, large-scale serial killer inquiries like that hadn't really been happening. It was a one-off, and it was an unusual one. George Oldfield, the senior investigating officer, was an assistant chief constable at the time. He was long in service. He'd been a police officer for many years. And he had quite a charismatic personality. He was well respected by the people that worked with him. But it's a time when people of that rank basically said it and people did it. So he was in complete charge of what the inquiry was about. So no matter what thoughts other people might have had, he said, that's the way we're going to go. And unfortunately, he received the tape from the person referred to as Wayside Jack with the northeast accent that sort of led them down a completely blind alley in terms of the inquiry and how it ran. And they started to use the northeast as an elimination process for suspects. So if somebody became a suspect in the inquiry, if they didn't have any connections to and didn't have a northeast accent, they were almost instantly eliminated.
So and that hoax...
Sorry,
I was going to say that hoax, just for people who don't know, that was at the end of the 70s, that was a person called John Humble, wasn't it?
It was indeed, yes.
He actually recently, interestingly, the reason I know the name so well, he was only recently arrested.
He was, yeah.
For that. Right. I think it was in the early 2000s, I think about 25 years later,
yeah.
Sentenced to 8 years in prison. So do you feel that really sent George spiralling down the wrong, you know, the wrong rabbit hole, as
completely.
It were?
I mean, there's something in the police service called case theory. And the problem with case theory, and it's something that there are now things called murder books. It's a plan of what you should do when you're actually conducting a murder inquiry. And one of them is about case theory. It's about the theories that suddenly take over the entire case, and you're then looking for evidence to prove that particular case theory that's in your head and discounting all the other evidence that actually might be valuable stuff that might take you somewhere else and lead eventually to the actual killer. And I think Wayside Jack, the tape that was received, the letters that were received, was just that. It became a case theory and something that he just said, right, this is the person. And despite sort of speaking to people from the FBI, for example, and people who were accent specialists and whatever, who all said, it's all right, but I wouldn't be too misled by that. There might be other lines of inquiry you should follow. He was determined that that was the route he was going to take. As a result, Peter Sutcliffe was obviously eliminated on the basis he didn't have a northeast accent, had never come from the northeast, never been in the northeast. He might have passed through it. So he wasn't a suspect of any interest.
That is incredible. And I suppose, to some extent, understandable that he would perhaps be so focused on this one break that you thought he'd found because of the immense public and media pressure. But a tragic, yeah, it sort of leads on to the next question I had, which is, and the answer might in a sense be answered already, but do you feel like the press coverage of the Yorkshire Ripper case aided or hindered the investigation?
Oh my gosh, it hindered it tremendously. The problem with the press is they are there to sell TV, newspapers, radio or whatever. So the headlines are always something that are eye-catching and glitzy. And often they would latch onto something like that and push it seriously to sell newspapers, I guess, in fairness. And a lot of it led to people contacting the murder inquiry team either on the telephone or writing to them and offering suggestions. And that just added to this huge weight of information and intelligence and misled people all over the place in terms of what they were getting in. Imagine that if you rang the murder room and you spoke to one of the detectives there and you said, I believe Bill Blackwood is actually the person you're looking for, that detective then has to raise an action, an inquiry, they have to assign a team of at least two people, possibly more, to go and investigate Bill Blackwood and to interview him, possibly arrest him and interview him, or just to interview him, to find out if there is any truth in that allegation. And then imagine the thousands of those inquiries that were coming through the incident room through press releases that were suggesting various things had been happening. And all of those had to be assigned in action and had somebody actually deal with them. And phenomenal waste of manpower and expense following up those sorts of leads. So the press often, and even today, hamper inquiries, really, because they're there to sell newspapers. And it's nice to report things and stir up the public, but sometimes it's not always that helpful.
No, absolutely. And I can imagine, like I say, I can absolutely imagine George Oldfield, the pressure on the entire police department. Definitely, you would be so desperate to find something that you could say, we're on the right track now. We've got this immense media scrutiny, this public scrutiny. We've got this audio recording. We're sure this is the guy. You know, it's Wearside Jack. We're gonna.
Yeah, but there are other things. For example, the tests on the envelopes, it returned the same blood group that Peter Sutcliffe had, which was a very rare, I think 6% of the population had that blood group. And by some strange coincidence, the person sending the letters, the person sending the recordings, had the same unusual blood group that Peter Sutcliffe did. And that just added to that belief that we've got the right person.
Yeah, tragic bad luck, I suppose.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, what can you say?
We've kind of covered the next question already, but Peter Sutcliffe was interviewed by police 9 times before being arrested. And do you feel like it was simply a matter of the Wearside Jack hoax and George Altfield's insistence that it had to be the guy? Is that the reason?
No, I don't think it is necessarily that. I do believe on at least one occasion, one of the interviewing detectives, they also always interviewed in pairs, one of the interviewing detectives suggested quite strongly that Peter Sutcliffe must be the Ripper. The problem you had is those 9 interviews are all recorded separately, of course, with the officers who actually conduct those interviews. And that information, because it's all held on paper and it's done over a lengthy period of time, there is no way of cross-referencing what was said in one interview with the other one easily. So you're dependent on individuals actually reading each of those interviews and seeing if there's anything that cross-references between them and if they actually tally with previous interviews as well. Now now there are computer systems. I mean, the one that is currently in use is one called Holmes. It's been in use since, early 2000s, I believe, or possibly the late 90s. And that automatically cross-references details, spellings, names, descriptions, and it compiles actions from those to suggest the line of inquiry for people. And that wasn't available. It was all done by people sitting down and reading and extracting information. 9 interviews is a lot of interviews, and it's a lot of information to start collating and putting together when you add it to all of the other things that were happening in the inquiry as well. So it was a difficult one to deal with. And of course, it wasn't the same detectives who did the 9 interviews. It would be different teams who would go out and do those on each occasion.
9 interviews it's far too many for someone who they were dismissing. So they certainly were close for a long time. Yeah. I think that's why a lot of people found themselves frustrated with the investigation. But I mean, they were doing what they could, of course. But I suppose we should move on now. So you mentioned earlier that the Peter Sutcliffe investigation was something new in the history almost of the English police force, manhunt for one killer. Can you tell us how the Yorkshire Ripper case affected the police department's handling of future murder cases?
Yeah, I mean, initially, because it was unique as an instance, I mean, we don't have, as a country, that many serial killers. I mean, there have been some since, I appreciate, but not on that scale. So initially, there would have been no impact on the police service. Certainly when I joined, they hadn't changed the way that murder inquiries were conducted. And it really wasn't until Lawrence Byford, who was the HMRC, the Magistrates Inspectorate of Constabulary, was asked to conduct an inquiry and went away and looked at all the information from the inquiry, from the murder inquiry, or the murders inquiry, and eventually released his report, that in 2006, so it's a long time afterwards, in 2006, things actually started to change in the way that murder inquiries were conducted and in terms of the way computer systems were being used. It was recognised instantly, obviously, that that weight of paper is difficult to manage. And it's okay if you're dealing with a one-off domestic murder. Most of your information and your intelligence is going to be around one incident, and it's going to be fairly easily obtainable. When you extend it to that sort of murder inquiry, it is difficult to manage that. And that's where the Home Office introduced its computer system.
So yeah. You feel it was primarily a technological advancement that occurred, which has changed how the police handle murder cases and serial murder cases?
Yeah, not just technological. And I think the way that senior investigating officers are assigned to cases now is dealt with in a different way. Again, Lawrence Byford had a major criticism about the appointment of George Oldfield based on the fact that he was an older, and he was a much older, experienced detective who had managed goodness knows how many different types of cases or whatever. Therefore, he would be the best man for the job. And he suggested that really you should be looking at somebody who might be able to handle that particular incident or those particular incidents much more closely and much more adroitly than that had been handled by George Oldfield.
Do you feel that's justified personally, knowing George?
Yeah, I do. I met the guy, and sadly, I mean, he died early 80s. He had a heart attack, which was initially put off as a chest infection, I believe, during the course of the inquiry, and so he was lifted away from it. He was eventually moved away from it completely, and the Ripper inquiry then ran its course with another senior investigating officer. Yeah, there was a massive bone of contention, because it was South Yorkshire Police, of course, who arrested Peter Sutcliffe. It was just one of those things. It was a police officer who was young in service. He was a probationer, out with his tutor constable in an area that is used by prostitutes. Peter Sutcliffe was with a prostitute at the time in his vehicle, and a check on the police national computer identified that the vehicle was on false plates. Peter Sutcliffe was arrested, asked if he could go for a pee, and disappeared, at which point it was discovered the day after he'd actually discarded, I believe, a hammer, a knife and a rope that he was intending to use to actually kill the prostitute that he was with. He was, because of his description and because of his details, he was transferred to West Yorkshire Police, where he was subsequently interviewed, and I think it was 2 days after the interview started, actually started to relate details of the murders that he conducted. For me personally, I don't think it really matters who arrested him. The fact he was arrested and the inquiry could actually move forward at a pace was useful in helping bring some sort of closure for a lot of people whose loved ones had been murdered. Don't forget, not all the people he murdered were prostitutes. There's still that suggestion, obviously, that they were all involved in prostitution. Not all of the people that he attacked, the 22 people, I think it was 13 that he actually definitely killed, and then there were a number of others injured. It's something that is important that he had, in terms of who he was targeting, it wasn't always prostitutes. It was women by themselves sometimes.
It's a side point that we don't need to get into if you don't want to. But there has been some criticism of the police at the time for their comments on prostitution. Are you familiar with the Jim Hobson famous press conference quote?
Yes, I am familiar with that quote,
yeah.
Definitely.
It's not a...
Unfortunately, in the 70s, I mean, and obviously before, but in the late 70s, mid to late 70s, early 80s, a lot of police officers' views of prostitutes would be that. And I think it's taken a long time to actually re-educate people in relation to what it's about and what those people are actually doing. I mean, it's still interesting that it's only recent changes that we've had that stop only punishing the person who is the prostitute and not the person who is the client, because surely one feeds the other.
Of course, yeah.
And it's only in recent times that that's changed, and there are actually punishments now in place to to deal with the client, if you like, as well as the prostitute. And of course, we do now have managed areas where prostitution isn't, where people aren't arrested for prostitution, but it's in an area that's managed.
In the interest of the safety of the prostitutes themselves.
Yeah. Very much so, yeah, and that again is and has always been an issue, that prostitutes were a massive risk from a lot of people who have, well, what shall we say, quite different views to mine, certainly, about people and what their worth is and what they can actually do with them, like Peter Sutcliffe.
Yes, exactly. So. No, it's an interesting tangent, certainly. I'm sure it's not an issue with the West Yorkshire Police or even with the police. An issue with the whole of society and attitude to sex workers and their vulnerabilities. But it was interesting that it came out as a result of the Sutcliffe case. But of course, yes, it's an ongoing issue, I'm sure. It's good to see that I do believe it's getting better and these people are getting treated with more respect and more care.
Yeah, absolutely. When I was a young PC, I mean, I don't know how you'd actually phrase it. I worked with a number of prostitutes. I was aware of what they did. I was aware of where they did it, and felt a certain responsibility for maintaining their safety, as well as trying to ensure that the law was upheld to an extent, you know?
Yes, exactly. I suppose it's a difficult line to walk in at the time.
That's what policing was. I mean, it was and still is, I guess, in fairness. Things are not always black and white. There's quite a lot of grey in there. And sometimes you have to navigate that grey area in a sensible way and in a human way and approach people with a lot of humanity that we don't always think of. I mean, the police are often target of the press, certainly, and of public opinion because of things they've done wrong. And very rarely do we see the praise for things that they did right. Nature of society, I guess, to a certain extent.
But, yeah, certainly in the nature of the press, that absolutely is. How it goes.
Yeah, but we don't see we don't necessarily see the good things that are happening as a result of. I mean, there are things happening in the country. I mean, I'm just trying to think. Is it 3 or 4 years ago now? Maybe it's longer that the security services via the government released the thing about the number of terrorist attacks that had been defeated by the security services that you will never hear about. Because they never happened. They were actually defeated before any action was taken, and that's purely as a result of action by the police service and the security services, MI5, MI6, and Special Branch. That happens on a daily basis. There are things that are prevented from happening because the police service are actually doing their job. And unfortunately, because the police service as a whole is a large organisation and covers the whole of society, you are going to have individuals in that service who are, for want of a better phrase, bad apples, who shouldn't be there and shouldn't be allowed to deal with members of the public. And they're the ones that we read about, of course, in the press.
Yeah, so there's an obvious information bias going out to the public, you feel, regarding the police in all investigations.
Yeah, I think there is. There's a lot of pressure applied to the police when they're actually investigating anything that's of public interest, and there is that pressure applied to get your man and get them quickly and do it as quickly as you possibly can. And again, that's something that inquiry teams have to step away from. It's about gathering intelligence, and the police service is much more intelligence-led now than it was when I joined in 1982. It's a much more robust system, and it's a much cleverer system than it used to be. To actually gather intelligence about various things that are happening. So that is something that has changed over time.
It's certainly an encouraging thought. I suppose we kind of lead into the next question I have. Naturally, I'm sure the answer, in a way, you've covered it, but did the media coverage or the Peter Sutcliffe case and the media circus around it and criticisms of the investigation, did this affect you as a police officer, or your desire to join the force, or even your view of the police, did it have an impact on you as an aspiring officer?
Yeah, it's you see it, you read it. I grew up with the on the outside as a member of the public. I was at university when I think it was Wayside Jack announced that there would be another murder in a walled city in England. I happened to be at university in York, a walled city. And I remember over the weekends that it was anticipated these murders were going to take place, the whole of the city centre was dead. It was always a throbbing mass of people moving about. It was completely dead and empty. There was nobody in it. And it was that to be part of a team that would eventually, obviously, he was arrested and interviewed, et cetera, taken to court and convicted. And it was, I suppose, part of that is the desire to be part of that system that can do that amount of good in society and take somebody like that away that has affected so many lives.
So you saw firsthand the incredible social impact of the terror that Sutcliffe and Wearside Jack too spread. And so you found it inspiring, ultimately.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate it was a flawed investigation. I appreciate that it perhaps could have been dealt with more expeditiously, and perhaps that Peter Sutcliffe could have been taken to court and convicted way before he was. But I also accept that having looked at it now and I understand how the computer systems work, I used to teach the computer systems, some of the in-house systems within West Yorkshire Police. And I grew up with, when I joined, I grew up with that paper file system. So if I wanted to know any piece of intelligence about any criminal that I was dealing with, if they lived within the division I lived in, I had to go to my local intelligence officer and look through the CARP files. If I wanted to know about somebody who lived in another police division, either neighbouring division or somewhere else in the force, I had to ring their collator's office. And if it was at night time, I had to get a PC from their office to go look in their CART system for me. So it's been interesting to see how those developments have changed the face of policing, ultimately, and to be part of that process of actually making that change.
It will continue, I'm sure, only continue to get better, more powerful tools.
Yeah, it will, absolutely. I was the training coordinator for a system called Viper after I retired. Escaping the police service isn't always interesting, and I was pulled back in. And Viper is the video identification parades electronically recorded. And that was a massive change in the way that police service operate as well. To actually conduct an identification parade was a really, really difficult task. Now it's done electronically with a database of volunteers. You don't have to go out every time you need to have an ID parade. So it's things like that that have changed from a computer standpoint that will aid inquiries like the Ripper inquiry that happened and that will crop up. They will happen again. There will be inquiries like that have to run again. But they will be operated, I think, in a slightly more efficient way.
Just following on from that point, you mentioned that you feel it'll happen again, and I suppose inevitably it will. Do you feel that your time as an officer and your familiarity with the Peter Sutcliffe case has given you any insight into the minds or workings of criminals like Sutcliffe?
I have an insight into the minds of some types of criminality. An insight into the mind of Peter Sutcliffe is a difficult one. Bear in mind, he's a man who claimed it was God who told him to go out and do it. He was only convicted of murder, or several murders, because a prison officer heard him discussing with his wife that if he spanned the right story, he would be committed as somebody with mental health issues versus as a murderer. So he lied throughout it. He went to his grave, I feel sure, and I'm sure the people involved in the inquiry know as well. He went to his grave without confessing to, I'm sure, a number of other incidents that he was involved in, or a number of other murders that he was involved in. So would I be able to, get into his mind and understand his line of thinking? Probably not. The same applies to a lot of other people that I've come across as well, who have committed, how do you say it? It's not even unusual crimes. Who have committed crimes that horrify the public. Mm. A thief you could understand, a car thief you could understand, but some of the other incidents, the murderers, and again, some murderers you can understand perhaps what drove them to do that, ultimately. And some others, you can't actually fathom it at all.
Yeah, it's mysteries of the human mind, isn't it, ultimately?
It is, yeah, very, very much so. Yeah, and the mind is a complex thing. And often, as Sutcliffe did, people come up with excuses that it wasn't me, it was God telling me to go out and do it. I don't believe for a minute Peter Sutcliffe heard the voice of God in his head telling him to take a hammer and a knife and do what he did to those poor people. I really don't.
That is fascinating. Thanks very much for that insight. Do you have any other stories you'd like to share from your time on the force, or anything you think we might like to hear?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had a very enjoyable service, and I worked with a number of departments throughout my time in the police service. It's interesting to see that the way the police service has changed since 1982 up to where we are now in 2021, in terms of the things that are available to police officers now that enable them to conduct their jobs more efficiently, more effectively. And it's also sad to see the way that the government has consistently cut the staffing levels in the police service to make it harder for them to actually do their job. The police, I think, personal view, obviously very much tainted by my service, still do a sterling job. It's certainly a different service to the one that I joined.
Of course. Well, it is wonderful to hear you reflect on that and reflect on your thoughts, because through true crime communication, which is what we do, we primarily focus on crimes that are unsolved.
Yeah.
So we deal usually with cases, they're usually American cases, to be honest, but from all over the world, but they are cases where the authorities and the police have failed.
Yeah.
So I feel like, in a sense, just by the nature of what we cover, there may be a bias naturally leaning in that the police mess up. So it is nice to hear, it's nice to have you on, and nice to hear your honest account of all the good that, you know, you feel that the police continue to do. It's essentially a fresh take.
It's nice to be part of that. It's a difficult one. As I say, I appreciate that I do have some bias. I was 20 years a police officer. That's a long time. That's a large chunk of your life. But I think we as a nation lose track of the fact that the police service do good. And yes, I know there are bad apples. There was a police officer in the Metropolitan Police Service abducted a woman and murdered her. And there are other incidents that have hit the press since then and before then. But we're talking about one person, one individual. We have that happening in society almost on a daily basis. But because it's the police service, yes, we should expect a much higher responsibility from them. They should behave impeccably and to the letter of the law. And that's what we should expect of the police service. But unfortunately, you're always going to have those few individuals who do not actually adhere to those standards. And that's the problem that we have. They're the people we hear about, and that is then reflected on the whole of the police service. Just like all the people in the NHS throughout this pandemic, the police service have been working out in the public, coming into contact with people who may or may not have coronavirus, and putting their lives at risk as well. But we don't hear a lot about that. It's those sort of things that concern me.
Well, thanks so much for sharing that, and thanks so much for being here. I'm sure by this point in time, everyone will have completely fallen in love with your voice. So do you want to share with how people can follow you and keep up with you and what you're doing now in the acting sphere?
Absolutely. I've got a number of things in the pipeline that aren't out there at the moment. And I've got some things that are. The easiest way to actually follow and see what I'm up to at this moment in time is to hit my website. And it's an easy one. It's billblackwood.com. All the information about me is on that website, including links to Spotlight, which is the big industry database of work that you've completed. So it's all on there.
Fantastic. Billblackwood.com. Wonderful. Well, thank you very much, Bill. It's been an absolute pleasure. I've loved it, and I hope you have too. We'd love to get you back at some point and maybe discuss another case or discuss more on the British police.
Yeah, I'm more than happy to do that, Will. Yeah, absolutely.
But thank you so much. I'll let you get off now. But that's wonderful. Thank you so much, Bill. And I hope everyone at home you enjoyed too. And we'll see you very soon. Thank you very much.
That's fabulous. Thank you so much, and take good care.
And there you have the facts. I hope you enjoyed that insight into the Yorkshire Ripper case and Bill's own incredible account of his experiences and thoughts on the matter. Please let us know down in the comments if you have any questions we can put to Bill, should he have the time to join us on the channel again. And please do check out his fantastic work on billblackwood.com.
leave this video a like and subscribe to support the channel, and check out our Patreon should you wish to support us further. Thank you for watching. Stay alert, stay safe, and I'll see you next time.